Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. This time, we continue our conversation with New Yorker staff writer Calvin Trillin, author of 30 books, including American Fried, Alice Let's Eat, and Third Helpings. They make up the brilliant Tummy Trilogy about the pleasures of eating regional food. Trillin recently collaborated with artist Roz Chast on a children's book entitled No Fair, No Fair, and Other Jolly Poems of Childhood. It comes out this fall. Over lunch at the Little Owl on his block in Greenwich Village, Bud, as his friends call him, was having a burger and confirming that he is not a fan of fancy Michelin-starred restaurants. It's very interesting that they can do this much to food, he said. But did God really intend this to happen?
Now, the other way to look at it is that I have a limited capacity for eating butter and an unlimited capacity for eating olive oil. So if I'm in France or Italy, I'm happy in the South.
You began to be uncomfortable with the notion that people regarded you as an arbiter of taste.
Absolutely, because I've never reviewed a restaurant. I don't know anything about food.
You have a really good palate, I think.
Well, what was that Justice Potter Stewart who said about pornography? I know it when I see it. I don't know how to define it. But because of that, I feel like sort of an imposter when someone says, what's the third best French restaurant in Chicago? I don't know. People assume that if you write about food, I think of myself as writing about food in order to make jokes and write about other things. And that food is sort of the conduit in there. On the other hand, I enjoy doing it.
You have a great passion for food.
Yeah, I mean, I loved, you know, I had the last New Yorker piece about food was about North Carolina barbecue. I loved eating the barbecue. I loved being with people who like barbecue. So it's fun, and it started that way. I mean, it started this as sort of, well, this is not one of those pieces where I'm going to have to hound the secretary to get the document I need, and all I have to do is eat a few things and find people to eat with.
When people started to take you seriously as an arbiter of taste, that's when you sort of decided to kind of write less about food.
I did. In the first place, after I quit doing the series around the country, I didn't need that comic relief. And for a few years, I don't think I wrote about it. Well, I hardly wrote about it. I made a run occasional piece. I think when Ruth Reichel became the editor of Gourmet, I started writing about mainly those pieces for Gourmet, and for a couple of the travel magazines were about not in America, they were somewhere else. I was sort of like one of those baby food companies that's not allowed to sell their stuff in America because it's poison, so they sell it in Africa or somewhere. I thought of it as kind of a way to kind of focus travel. That was more fun for me if Alice and I went somewhere to be looking and have some angle.
So you figured out a way to make it fun again.
Yeah. And I did that for a while, and then I got so that I was basically writing a food piece once a year for the food issue of the New Yorker.
I'm curious, you ordered the gumbo. You know your way around gumbo in its place of origin, yet you're pretty impressed with Joey's version.
Yeah, I think for a displaced gumbo, I mean, a New York gumbo that was quite good. I would need to ask Joey whether he actually spent an hour and a half stirring the Rue.
Exactly. Because if he says 35 minutes...
No, he's off the list. I'm going to...
You're not coming back.
That's the end. That's the end of my patronage.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Maybe had somebody else stir it for an hour and a half.
So you've written about so many things. What makes you interested in writing about something?
Well, it depends on the kind of piece I'm going to write. If it's a reporting piece, it's often has to do with some tension between one group of people and another group of people. A narrative line is basically what I think a lot of reporters, magazine writers are looking for. And I think that's why I've written about murder so much, because there's a beginning and a middle and always an end.
There's always an end.
But on the other hand, sometimes things, for what we used to call casuals, now called shouts and murmurs at the New Yorker, might be, I did one about not wanting a walk-in bathtub, despite all of the emails I got offering to sell me a walk-in bathtub. And there's a series of letters about what makes you think I'm ready, as you put it, for a walk-in bathtub. And might interest you to know that I've just gotten an email the day before asking if I wanted to meet some beautiful women from an exotic country. Does that sound like someone who's ready for a walk-in bathtub? I was kind of intrigued by all this email traffic on walk-in bathtubs, even what walk-in bathtubs were. I mean, presumably not the bathtub that walked in, but you walk in the bathtub and then you kind of sat there and it was cold until the water came on. Anyway, it's not a kind of thing I would want to write a reporting piece about. So it sort of fit.
So that's essentially a humor piece.
That's a humor piece, yeah. Attempt a humor piece.
Well, we're going to get to humor in a second.
Well, you know, Ring Lardner said when people, his son said, when people ask you what you do for a living, why do you never say humorist? And he said, it's like saying, people ask you what you do and say, I'm a great third baseman. I mean, there's an implication in the word that it's actually funny. Some people laughed, some people didn't laugh.
It's true, though. He's right. I want to talk to you about writing in general. You know, you write with such seemingly effortless style and grace and precision, and somehow your writing is simultaneously conversational and elegant. Who influenced your writing the most?
You know, There's certainly reporters that I admired a lot. Joe Mitchell, A.J. Liebling, and that group of people. But I don't know, if I read one of their pieces and read one of my pieces, there would be very much overlap in style. I think you sort of have to find your own voice, and I'm not sure how that's done.
Is that a linear process?
I think at some point you just think, yeah, that's what I'm supposed to sound like, which I don't mean that it's necessarily the same voice you have in conversation, but for a while when I spoke to journalism or writing classes, I always say, how do you find your voice? And voice was very popular at one point, and then audience got popular. Who's your audience? And if you're writing humor, you really can't think about who the audience is, because this humor is very unpredictable and very personal, so and indefensible. You can't say to the woman who doesn't laugh in the second row, people much more sophisticated than you have laughed at that joke. And what's, I mean, you can, if she didn't laugh, it's not funny to her. Oh, here comes a lot of food. Thank you. I'm not using ketchup. Oh, okay. I'm a mustard man.
Mustard, okay.
I think I have an unconscious rule of mustard with cheeseburgers, ketchup without. I'm not here often for dinner, but if I have to have lunch with somebody, I usually can walk in.
Dinner, it gets crazy, right?
Yeah. It's delicious. I know I'm only going to have it one time in my life, cheeseburger. That's the other thing that makes me feel okay about eating it. I just needed to try it.
And you've never had it here?
Never had it. It's 20 yards from my house. It's the slider problem, I told
you. Right.
Because I just needed to have it. If I get the sliders, right. then I, it seems...
Redundant.
You were talking about voice and how you go about developing a voice. And you were saying that it's not a linear process and, you know, that you... it's hard to tell somebody how to do that.
I'm not sure, because... I was interested, you know, that professor at, I think it was Vassar, who could identify anonymous writing. He did that book that Joe Klein did, Primary Colors, that he, by computer, can figure out who wrote this.
Right.
By comparing it with the rest of your writing. I was thinking about it when someone said you'd use a tape recorder in one of some journalism class, and I said, if I'm in a public hearing or something, I sometimes use a tape recorder, and somebody who talks fast. I remember using a tape recorder on that piece that I did on people who eat in the burrows. And Jim Leff talked very fast. But ordinarily, I don't use a tape recorder, and I realize I don't use long quotes. Ordinarily, I mean, I have used long quotes, but ordinarily, I'm one sentence here and one sentence there, so you wouldn't need a tape recorder for that. But if somebody had said to me before, "How do you feel about quotes?" I hadn't thought of it.
Right.
I think all that stuff just has to evolve, and then you think, well, that sounds right or that doesn't sound right.
And did you think? When you first started writing for The New Yorker, for example, there was no, okay, when I first started, I was sounding like this person or that person?
No. I had come to The New Yorker from Time Magazine, where you sounded like Time Magazine.
Right.
But I think maybe I was aware of the different pace. You can wander around a bit. In Time Magazine, it was all that Time style, which is gone now, but was really basically more or less gone when I was there.
Sure.
But the stuff of backward sentences, wheeled the mind, or Snaggletooth author Jones and stuff like that.
Right.
That, a lot of that was for space. Because...
Sure.
And I used to... When I was a writer at Time, I did both ends of what were they called group journalism. But when I was a writer at Time in New York, sometimes I'd write a 70-line story, and there was one fact that just didn't fit. And sometimes I'd, if I had time, I'd go home. The kind of the rumbling of the subway sometimes it came into my head. But then I got to the New Yorker, and I thought, well, this first piece I wrote turned out to be a book-length piece. There was one fact that didn't fit. I mean, so it didn't make any difference that it was much longer.
Wow.
It still had to be organized. I always think of the structure being the hardest part of writing.
But the internal logic of your writing is astonishing to me. It's like, but that's hard work, right?
Yeah, the structure, I mean, it's different. It's sort of like trying to make a trail through the forest. Sometimes you see these openings, and sometimes it just all seems just sort of a mess, and you have to hack through it. But I think for each sentence can be written as well as you can write it if you write it enough times. It may not be as well as John Updike could have written it, but it'd be as good as you can write it. But the structure leaves open the possibility of just not being able to get from A to B to C to D. So that seems to me in nonfiction writing the hardest part.
You mentioned humor, and you know, you won the James Thurber Prize. How does a sense of humor develop?
I think some people are just hardwired to see the world in a slightly oblique way, and some people aren't. Used to always be said, there was a cliche years ago, always, you can't teach people to write. You can teach people to write, because writing is just kind of thinking. You can teach people to express themselves better and organize things better. But I think it's almost true with humor that you can't teach people to be funny. I guess you can get better at it, but it's certainly not correlated with intelligence. I mean, there's some really bright people writing humor, and there's some that aren't that bright.
Right.
And the same thing with stand-up comics or something. And when you start out, all you can do is please yourself. I make myself laugh about every 2 or 3 years writing a piece. I find a little giggle coming out. It's usually some surprise that I didn't know was going to be there. And so I always think, well, if I'm held hostage for a couple of years, I wouldn't be totally without resources. Every so often I could give myself a little giggle. But you can't think, would that appeal to so-and-so? Or after voice was popular in writing classes, audience became popular. And I've never thought much about the audience, because it's hard to predict who they are. And that first food book wasn't exactly a collection, but there were a lot of lumps of New Yorker pieces and that sort of scrambled up for the book.
Right.
And a couple of Playboy pieces.
Yes.
I don't think anybody could tell the pieces that originated in Playboy.
Right.
Originated in the New Yorker.
Right. The first paragraph is from Playboy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are obviously references that you can't use. When I did what my daughters call the first one-ham show at the American Place Theater,
that was your one-man show, which they called the one-ham show.
Yeah, I actually did two of them. This was the first one in 88. And I talked about this organization that I belonged to when I was going around the country doing these U.S. Journal pieces. There was a fine reporter from the AP, Jules Lowe, who was doing a similar thing. And we had an organization called American Association of American Correspondents Covering America. Our acronym was GLINGPAC. We just liked the way that sounded. And our headquarters was in O'Hare Airport, where we spent most of our time. And there were only two of us in the organization. And there was only one rule, which was you can't quote de Tocqueville. And then somebody said, you should think about moving that evening to Broadway. And Alice said, they don't do de Tocqueville jokes on Broadway. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
There are obviously references that change for audience, but in general, if you try to figure out what somebody would like or anything, it's just meaningless. You can't do it.
Now, I saw you once give a talk at the Southern Foodways conference we both attended, and I was amazed because you kept jokingly asked me if I would finish writing your speech all weekend, and then we finally, when I drove you to the courthouse where you gave the speech, all I saw on a piece of paper were three bullet points. Yeah. I thought, how does someone, and then you just completely tore it up, like you were hilarious and it was organized. And how did you go from three bullet points written on a piece of hotel stationery to that perfect 45-minute speech?
Well, I'm ashamed to say some of it might be that stuff I'd known because I had written it or knew from before or had actually repeated in a speech, unlike all the politicians. I actually have repeated some things in speeches. I remember thinking about it once in the green room on the Johnny Carson show, and I thought, why is it that you're not worried about this? This is a lot of people watching and everything. And I don't know. that was the first time I thought
that was the extent of your concern.
That was the extent of my concern. I said, I don't know.
What do you think? I mean, do you follow what's going on in the food culture now? You know, I mean, there's so much food media, and there's, you know, is it all just white noise to you?
Somebody called me on the phone once and asked me what my favorite food books were, and I said, well, I've never read a food book, except my own. I mean, in proof.
Right.
But I found it sort of interesting, the development of the whole food thing, the role of the Immigration Act and the role of the shakeup in the 60s, there's a huge difference between what people thought of as kind of the restaurant culture in 1958 and what they thought of it, and even in the, you know, 20 or 30 years later.
Right. But that's almost like an anthropological interest.
Yes, yeah. And I was interested in that some of the well-known chefs were anthropology graduate students, or I think Rick Bayless was an anthropology graduate
right.
student. A couple of people were involved. And that the fact that it didn't develop the way European food culture developed. I mean, that the instead of having the kind of imperious chef with a big high toque and guy who had apprenticed to a restaurant at 14 or something, you had these guys who had been kicking around
right.
graduate yeah, yeah. programs in various places, wore baseball hats.
Sure.
It was American.
Yeah.
And then the great change, the 65 Immigration Act, which I know that a change in food culture should not be mentioned on the same plane as a change in involuntary servitude, but for people interested in eating, the 1965 Immigration Act was our Emancipation Proclamation.
Right, and just so everyone understands, the 65 Immigration Act enabled many people from many different cultures.
Right, until then there was a national quota system which favored the UK and Northern Europe. And we actually were admitting more English people than wanted to come while keeping out Chinese people, in culinary terms, suicidal. based on the theory that people eat bland food make better citizens than people who don't. That doesn't make sense.
That doesn't make sense.
And the fact that it was by plane this time instead of ships meant that, you know, there's a huge Bosnian presence in St. Louis. I mean, they're spread out. The Hmong are in Minnesota.
Right. So this is a question I've been meaning to ask you for the longest time. What would be in your desert island fridge? I mean, I've seen your fridge. I know the kinds of things that are in it.
Right.
And it has a freezer. Right. So, like, give me the five things that would be in your desert island fridge.
That's a good desert island with electricity.
Yeah, it's an exceptional desert island.
Well, I guess I'd have some boudin.
Got to have some boudin.
And I'd have some after boudin. I probably might have something like another Cajun dish, like crawfish etouffee or something. I'd have if we could get the original burnt ends of the brisket from Arthur Bryan's. They don't make them the same way anymore.
No. You might have to get LC's instead.
Yeah.
They're good.
And LC, my friend Fats Goldberg, of blessed memory, went to LC's when it first opened and asked for a beef sandwich. And he said, you put the sauce on the side. And LC said, that'll be 50 cents extra. And Fats was very impressed. He said, that's a real barbecue guy.
That's funny.
And I guess Winstead's hamburger would have to be there.
Okay.
Well, we're getting pretty close to.
So we got three. We've got no. We got four.
We've got four.
We've got crawfish etouffee, boudin, a Winstead's hamburger, and burnt ends.
Burnt ends.
Stroud's fried chicken.
Some Chinese dish probably. I just had some crispy eels that I liked.
Those green sandwiches you turned me on to. I don't know if that.
They were really good, but I tried them. They disappeared for a while.
And now they're back, but they're not as good.
They're back, but they're not as good.
No, I hate that.
The other thing I can't find anymore in Chinatown, those rolled up rice noodles with dried shrimp in them. Wow.
Yeah, those are good. I think I have some places for you for those. Who's the one person that you've never broken bread with that you would be interested in having a meal with?
Wow, a live person?
Doesn't have to be live.
I think it's funny because somebody asked me yesterday, or when I was in some class, is there anything you wish you had written that you didn't write? And I said what I had said, asked that years ago on a radio program. Flying too high with some guy in my sky is, in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. So Cole Porter would be, he'd be interesting to have. I'd like to ask him a few things about lyrics and stuff.
Yeah, and he'd have some splaining to do, probably.
Yes. I mean, it's different from writing. I write sort of light verse, which is, Stephen Sondheim has pointed out that poetry is different from lyrics in that the lyrics have to, you have to understand the lyrics as they're said. You can kind of muse on poetry.
Right.
But you have to understand a song. It has to be open enough that you can get to the thing. Anyway, one of those guys would be nice to have dinner.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you so much, Bud Trillin, for sharing your special sauce. You can read Bud's poetry in The Nation, for which he's now up to $100, which I'm very impressed by. Also in The New Yorker and in the forthcoming children's book that he wrote with Roz Chass doing the illustrations. Did I get the name right? No Fair, No Fair, Another Jolly Poems of Childhood?
That's it. It's not coming out till the fall.
Right.
There's a collection of race pieces coming out, I guess, in June.
Oh, great. And what's that called?
That's called Jackson 1964 and Other Dispatches on Race in America.
Your collections are so great. I mean, the humor collection is extraordinary. And if people, Serious Eaters, have not read the Tummy Trilogy, they should immediately get a copy because it is one of Calvin Trillin's many gifts to us. We'll see you next time on Special Sauce, and thank you again, Bud.
Thank you, Ed.